it will remain my stardust melody, the memory of love's refrain.
It's Radio Mysterio, so should I play the theme? Paul, should I play the theme? You're not even patched through yet, but Paul, should I play the theme?
Yes, you should play the theme.
Okay, we'll play the theme.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives.
Miserable lives.
And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso.
Yeah, I was just getting a couple of batteries here in case my recorder runs out. It's Radio Mysterioso, and we're on here with Paul Kimball. Let me fade this so that I can plug Paul into the feed. So you'll be fed some Paul Kimball here. Paul, can you hear me?
Oh, yes, I can hear you, Greg.
Oh, there we go. Wow, that's nice. That sounds really good. It sounds like you're like in the studio or something. That's why I like Skype when it works.
Well, I wish I was in the studio because, see, now you've made me sad. Because now I'm thinking that instead of being on the East Coast of Canada, as lovely as that is, I could be on the West Coast of California in the studio.
You could. I was thinking about that today while Paul is crying there, that I hadn't seen Paul in a while in person, and he's been very busy, and I hope we don't diverge too much in our interests, although I don't know how that could happen. Paul, if you don't know who he is and haven't been listening to the show, then I'm not going to say anything about it, except that he's a filmmaker. Probably people on this show know him for Fields of Fear, which was his documentary on the cattle mutilation phenomenon in Canada, and also Best Evidence, Top 10 UFO Cases. But many, many other films, a couple of features that are out. Well, one that is out, one, it has been out, and one that's coming up. And another one you're starting in the fall, right?
Yeah, that's right. And you are the only person who would ever introduce me and say Fields of Fear before Best Evidence.
Well, I did it chronologically, Paul.
No, I was thinking you did it because Fields of Fear is the one that you're in.
Yes, I don't know why I wasn't in Best Evidence, but yeah, I was in Fields of Fear.
Hey, I like Fields of Fear. I actually think Fields of Fear is a better film. It's a all of these films, by the way, if we talk about them tonight, folks, Tim Crawford at UFO TV and Paranormal TV have them for free. You can watch them now for free on YouTube, or you can go to my company's website and see them there, or you can buy the DVDs, but you know, unless you really want the DVD, you can watch them for free. And I, you know, Fields of Fear is a traditional documentary, beginning, middle, end story, sort of a biography of this guy named Fern Belzil investigating cattle mutilations. Best Evidence, Top 10 UFO Sightings, isn't really a documentary. There are 10 teeny tiny individual documentary segments within it.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's kind of a top 10 list. So,
yeah.
I think actually Fields of Fear is probably the last pure documentary I made because I shot that in 2005, right, and it was released in 2006, and sort of since then it's either been feature films or the Ghost Cases series or Best Evidence, but not pure, you know, those one-hour kind of documentaries for television that I began my career doing, and that I kind of miss, actually.
Yeah, well, you kind of went back to it with Ghost Cases, right? Did that ever show up on network anywhere? I guess it did in Canada first.
It did, and they've actually. So I have nothing to do with it. It only ran for one season, and then my partner. It was a co-production between my company and another company, and I wound up doing all the work, and he wound up keeping all the intellectual property. So there's the entertainment industry for you. But his company owns it all now. I get a royalty report. No money, but a royalty report every 6 months. But it has sold. Here we go. We are now airing. Holly and I are very popular in Albania, Thailand, and Iran. So one-third of the Axis of Evil, a country probably best known in North America for its child sex trade, and yes. I don't even know what Albania is known. King Zog. You know, a country that was formerly ruled by a guy named King Zog. So that's where I'm very popular in those three countries.
Or I think the country of John Belushi's ancestry, I believe. Not sure.
Could very well be, actually. Yeah. I don't know. But I guess the most famous Albanian that I know of, anyway, is King Zog. And he's pretty a cool guy, actually. He ran sort of a tribal chieftain who rose to become king. I laugh whenever I say this, king of Albania in the 1920s and 1930s, and was eventually overthrown by the Italians under Benito Mussolini. So I've always actually had a very fond spot in my heart for King Zog, just because it's a cool name, too.
It is a great name. Too bad he wasn't the ruler of Ur.
I am King George of, you know, the British Empire. And who are you? I am Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany. Oh, that's impressive. And who are you? Hey, I'm King Zog of Albania. All right, let's get down.
Yeah.
Let's get groovy, man. Kind of how I picture King Zog.
Where's the drinks? Where's the girls?
Exactly. Hey, baby, where's the drinks? Where's the girls? And by the way, isn't the king of Bulgaria King Carol? That's a girl's name. That's crazy. Only in Eastern Europe.
Is it right now?
No, they haven't had a king in Bulgaria since the war.
No, I didn't think so, but I thought maybe somebody was running around saying they were king. But that's a Polish name, isn't it? It's Eastern European name. Carol.
No, it was, the anglicized spelling is Carol, and actually, you know what, I think I'm wrong. I think it was one of the kings of Romania, so don't,
oh, okay.
I think I screwed up my Eastern European history. I think Carol was a king of Romania, not Bulgaria. Right, it was, they were czars in Bulgaria, and it was Ferdinand and a bunch of, Simeon. There are actually, here's a trivia
John
thing.
John Paul's first name was Carol, I think, John Paul I.
I have an uncle named Carol, too, so I shouldn't make fun of him.
Stan Friedman's real name is Carol?
No, different uncle. Although Stan's brother-in-law, my uncle Carol. There are actually, I believe, three former heads of state from the Second World War that are still alive. King Michael of Romania, who was the last king of Romania. Tsar Simeon of Bulgaria.
Simeon?
Simeon, S-I-M-E-O-N.
Okay.
He was very young. He was just a boy during the war, so he's kind of the regent, and then the communists overthrew all these guys.
Yeah.
But Simeon actually came back about 10 years ago and was elected prime minister of the new independent, free, non-communist Bulgaria that's part of the European Union. So not only was he technically the king or the czar of Bulgaria back when they had royalty, but I think he's probably the only royal in the history of Europe who was also elected 6 decades later as Prime Minister of Bulgaria, which, to me, that's a fascinating sort of historical story. I can't remember who the third surviving head of state is, by the way. I can't remember who it is. I think there's a third.
Yeah, I don't know when Hirohito died. I think it was in the 70s or 80s or something.
Oh, yeah, he's been dead, I think, for 20 or 25 years.
Yeah.
Not exactly sure.
See, when I was a kid, I was amazed that he was still the Emperor of Japan. I was like, what? That guy's from World War II.
Well, yeah, you would think so, seeing how they put Mussolini in front of a wall and shot him. And
yes.
Hitler they would have killed if he hadn't killed himself. Okay, two of the three Axis powers, the heads of state, gone. What are we going to do with the third? Well, let's just let him stay emperor. Why not?
Take any kind of power away from... Well, he didn't have any beforehand, but...
Well, that's an interesting historical question. People debate just how much power or influence the emperor had before and during the war.
I think he had enough so that if he said something, stuff would get done. Government, but he had a very large say in what was going on.
I think he certainly would have had enough that there was culpability there, that he should have been considered a war criminal. But for political reasons, they decided to retain the imperial family, even as they stripped the system of empire.
Yeah.
So it's not even the Japanese Empire anymore, but they have an imperial family as the head of state. It's actually a very complicated political system that the Americans devised.
Yeah.
So it's as if they left the Japanese with a puzzle. Hey, take 70 years, figure this out, and by then, hopefully, you won't be able to cause any more trouble.
Yes. So. Well, I think that was the idea. My mother just went and got a medal from the Emperor of Japan about a month ago.
Oh, well, see, now that's cool.
Yeah. Not Hirohito, though, because it couldn't have been. It was a month ago. It was his son.
Akihito.
Yes. Just came. He's very old, too. He's like in his late 70s, I think, or maybe even older.
He's getting up there.
He looked. Listen to, she said that he looked. My dad actually said he looked rather gaunt and weak.
Well, we might look gaunt and weak at that age too.
You don't think of an emperor just kind of like wheezing around, but that's what happens. So,
I think we just spent the first 10 minutes of your show talking about royal families and empires and stuff, which. I guess that's Mysterioso type material.
I don't know. I was going to look up and see how many people were listening, and I'm sure we've lost listeners. I'm almost positive. Yes, we have.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't look at the beginning. See, last week when I had nobody on, it was just me talking to Ward, I had 13 listeners. We now have 7.
Well, to the 6 people who didn't show up, I say, screw you. And we can bring this into the paranormal realm by discussing the David Icke theory that all royal families are really lizard people.
Right.
And that sort of brings it back to the paranormal, I guess.
I guess it sort of kind of does. I don't think he's going to be out at this thing at the Metaphysics Institute. What's it called? Contact in the Desert. This is next weekend at Joshua Tree in Joshua Tree, California, actually halfway between Joshua Tree and Yucca Valley. With such luminaries as Richard Dolan and Stephen Greer, which to me are almost polar opposites, but that's beside the point. It's another one of those conferences where they try to get everybody, and probably 90% of them are insane. And I'm still going to go.
Yeah, I'm not sure they're quite as polar opposite as you might think they are. I mean,
well, I don't know. I'm trying to be nice to Rich because I like and respect him.
I like him as a person.
Yeah.
My respect level for him has diminished with each passing year, but he's a very nice guy.
I don't agree with him, but it doesn't, you know, I guess because I like him as a person and he's always been very nice and supportive to me, I respect him. I don't agree with him on quite a few things, but I do respect him.
Well, let's try not to be controversial tonight. Let's just be friendly.
Did you see that thing on Facebook? Was that what you saw?
I did, yeah. Oh, okay. Let's just be friendly and funny and talk about cool things and not slag people.
I haven't slagged anybody.
I know, but I will.
Controversy, perhaps. Interesting, most certainly.
What? I'm not going to slag anyone.
Nah.
Well, okay. Well, maybe a few.
All right. Oh, speaking of slagging people or slighting them, you had Lance Moody on your show a while back. I haven't listened to it.
Yeah. I don't know why that's slagging anyone, but
no, it's not really slagging. I don't find any problem with what he's with his methodology. I don't like it though. I don't see why people have to. I was not excited about him taking down what's his name, Imbrogno, as other people were.
Well, I wasn't excited. First of all, we did actually in the episode because I, for people who are wondering,
because he did a really good job of it.
Yeah, and I run a podcast myself, so...
Yes, I'm sorry, I should have said Paul's podcast.
Yeah, just in case people are wondering, what the heck are they talking about, Lance Moody? And one of the guests I had in what I'm calling the second season is a skeptic named Lance Moody, mm-hmm. who I consider a friend, works in the film industry in the United States. And Lance was the guy a couple of years ago who, as Greg said, brought down... I mean, which makes it sound like Imbrogno was in, you know, on the top of some sort of mountain, but I guess he was.
Well,
revealed
whatever.
That Imbrogno had, you know, was, and I suppose still remains, a serial liar about his entire background and who he was, in a way that kind of makes Bob Lazar look like, you know, the epitome of honesty. So Lance, I mean, there's no doubt, Lance went out, and he sort of just did some basic research that nobody had ever really bothered to do.
Yeah.
Because Imbrogno had been on all these shows. And there were two groups of people. There were people who had had him on their shows and had worked with him and supported him who should have looked into his background but didn't. And then there was another group of people like me who hadn't really ever heard of him. I mean, he just wasn't on my radar. So, you know, when the revelations came out, it took all of about 10 minutes of my time. It's like, good work, Lance. You know, that's a valuable thing that you've done. And we're out. But, you know, because people within ufology have very little to talk about except other people in ufology.
Yes.
Because it's like high school. The Imbrogno thing went on and on and on and on and on.
Everything's like high school.
Because here we are still kind of talking about it. Well, and Lance and I talked about it, too.
Yeah. What really? What did he say about it? Besides, you agreed that it was a good thing that he had been caught lying over and over and over again.
No. I mean, I just asked him, like, this is sort of the thing you're most famous for as a skeptic, Lance, is your takedown, so to speak, of Bill Imbrogno.
Sounds like a big wild animal that he shot and then, like, kind of wrestled to the ground by himself.
Just kind of explain it, you know, I think it was 5 minutes in the episode, and then we moved on to talk to about a bunch of other things. Because there's a lot of stuff that Lance and I agree on, and there's other things that we don't agree on. So, but we had a very polite, civil, friendly conversation. In fact, Rich Reynolds posted a link to it at his blog, and I paraphrase, but he said it was very polite, civil, reasonable, and kind of dull. He was expecting fireworks. He was expecting us to name names and start slagging people and yelling and frothing at the mouth. And
why would you do that?
I have no idea. And I think he was expecting Lance.
Because
Lance and I can both, me more in the past maybe, and Lance I think still in the present. We could be feisty on internet message boards or whatever and that sort of stuff, but I think we're getting older and mellower. So we just had a very civil, polite conversation. And I might have edited out one or two things that I said. For instance, that almost all ufologists are stupid. I think I took it out. Oh, shoot. And I just said it again. Oh, well, there you go.
Oh, you've made a horrible mistake. I'm sorry.
Well, for the 7 listeners.
Yes.
Oh, wait, you podcast this.
You podcast, and then there's about 700.
Oh, well.
I'm going to leave it in, Paul. I'm just going to leave it in.
Yeah, please do. You can leave whatever I say in. Just please, please dig out Ufological Deathmatch Wrestling episode. Find that somewhere.
And I'm still looking in the archives here. I think you had narrowed it down to a year, but I can't remember what that year was. Was it 06 or 07, something like that? It couldn't have been 06 because that's when that's when Project Beta came out. We met after that, so it's probably 7 or 8, 9.
Yeah, I could probably find an exact date because I posted an entire rundown, a match summary, if you will, on my old blog, and I did that a couple weeks afterwards. So I'm pretty sure I did, and I could do it again. But for folks who don't know, we kind of did a ufological, an entire Radio Misterioso with Greg's wife, Sigrid, in the sort of laughing in the background, where we did death matches between various ufologists. Don Ecker versus Kevin Randall, Stephen Greer versus Marshall Applewhite. I think that was the final. I think those were the two survivors.
And Marshall Applewhite won just because of virtue of being more batshit insane than Stephen Greer.
Right. And to get into the final, Stephen Greer's final match was Stephen Greer versus reality, and Greer won.
Yeah.
Which, when you think about it, he took down reality. That's pretty cool.
And he continues to do so. We even had, I had a sports, old record of sports sound effects, and we actually had the sound of a boxing match bell going off.
That's right. And you had a guy, because we drove him, whose name I can't remember, but we drove him home, and he lived in some neighborhood, Echo Park or someplace that I hadn't been. And he was a very nice fellow, but
well, I can't remember his last name. I just know him as James.
I think he did the bell, and he kind of did some mad, like, you know, coming up next, Don Ecker and Kevin Randall. I think he did the voiceover or something like that. So I think Sigrid did the bell.
Oh, okay.
It was fun. That's my second favorite Radio Misterioso episode. My first being the Greg, Paul, Mac, Tony's jam session that we did in 2006.
Yes. So. When you guys were out here shooting part of Best Evidence.
Yeah, that's right. It was fun. I know you don't want to post it because I know it would offend an awful lot of people. Fortunately, there were only like 8 people listening, so there's a very small witness pool that can prove we actually said many of the things that we said. because if you want to talk about
oh,
slang,
I would listen to it very thoroughly before I posted it.
I mean, it was all the thing is, it was all done in good fun. We made as much fun of ourselves and our friends, Mac Tonies. We made fun of Mac, and we definitely made fun of Nick Redfern.
Yes.
Stan Friedman.
I think so. Nick wasn't in one of the fights. No.
Yes, he was.
Was he really?
Yeah.
Was he early on? Well, he wasn't nuts enough to keep going. That's why.
No, he lost. I think he lost out in the first round.
Yeah.
It was a fight in a mosh pit, which, I mean, you know, it was all people we knew, and there were a couple of things that we did that, yeah, I'm pretty sure that the people, if they heard it, would go, "We're really offended by this." And I think you and I both know who we're talking about in particular, and we won't say his name. So you can take that match out.
Yes.
Because I know we both know which one we're talking about.
Yeah.
Take that match out and just say, and in an earlier match, so-and-so defeated so-and-so. Moving on. But it's kind of legendary. Mac heard it. I remember he was listening, and he said he heard it, and he thought it was hilarious. So.
Well, Mac knew who we were talking about. I'm sorry he wasn't here. But
he would have been the voice of reason. We could have had him interviewing people after their matches or something.
Yeah, well, I don't know who would have played the parts of the crazy people.
That's what you and I were there for.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I could have done a passable Marshall Applewhite, but you'd have to blink a lot and sit. Basically, I guess he's like a space age Charles Manson, except he didn't have his followers go out and kill people. He had them kill themselves.
Yeah, well, he doesn't sound like anything now because he's been dead for what, 15 years?
Yes, exactly. Were you listening when Go Rightly was on a couple weeks ago and we played the audio from an old Ben Stiller show? It was a parody of Lassie, except Lassie was Manson.
No.
If you look up Stiller Manson on YouTube, you can find it. And in the beginning is like there's Lassie music or something, and a little kid says, "Manson," and he comes running, and he jumps over a fence just like Lassie.
I actually had Adam on my show this, I think he's episode 3 this season,
yeah.
And I started asking him about Manson, and eventually he sort of talked about it, but he was like, you know, I don't really like talking about Manson anymore because that's so yesterday, and I went, well, that's what you're most, like, known for, and okay, fine. So he indulged me for 5 minutes, and then he insisted on talking about other things.
He brought it up, plus it was really funny. I showed people at work, it went viral a little bit.
That's terrible. See, that just ticks me off.
Why?
No, I'm just kidding. We had a good conversation about other things.
What did you guys talk about?
What did we talk about? You know what? Conspiracies. Talked about conspiracies a little bit. Obviously, we talked about Manson. We did talk about Billy Joel, but I edited that stuff out.
Was something that the controversial part? Is that where he kept telling you? You kept yelling bullshit at him or something?
No, we talked for an hour and a half, and, you know, I try and get the shows down between 55 minutes and an hour and sort of 5 minutes, so I always wind up editing some stuff out. Plus, I'm a professional. By professional, I don't mean professional podcaster. I mean, I'm a media professional. That's what I do. I make films, I edit, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, I go through and I edit for quality control, too. I try and get rid of the ahs and the hisses and the... And, you know, all those kind of things.
Yeah. I try to get rid of them, too. But what I do, actually, is if it was a real good conversation and I remember it as being a good conversation, I sometimes just don't touch it.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure it's going to take you at least 8 hours to fix this one the way we've started. The first 10 minutes.
So far, I'm not going to touch it. No,
I'm leaving it in.
I don't care if people get bored. I was interested. That's the thing, Paul. I think we're kind of the same way. If I'm interested in what's going on, I really don't care if the audience is interested or not, because if they like the show, they'll keep listening. If not, then that's fine. I'm not getting paid for it. I don't have any commercials. I don't have to worry about it. So if it's interesting to me, then it's interesting. And that what more can you ask for if you're doing something like this? So,
no, I agree. And I was the other thing too is I'm actually planning at the you know I'm going to do about in the first season quotation marks I did 12 episodes. I think I'll do 13, and then by the time I'm done, which will be early September, I'll be in pre-production for my next film, so I won't be able to do any podcasting for a while.
Yeah.
But the idea is kind of, hey, if I talk to... I just talked to Dean Radin this past week. I'm editing his episode now.
Yeah.
You know, if I talk to him for an hour and 20 minutes, if I use an hour of it, then there's going to be 10 or 15 minutes of cool stuff that I plan to use sort of bonus materials at the end of the season. Like, here's some stuff you didn't hear, folks. Here's some, what do they call them on DVDs or Blu-rays? Easter eggs or something like that.
Yeah.
So, although in Raiden's case, the way it's going, I don't think there'll be anything that I cut except my own stuff. Stupid questions.
You can't really cut anything out of a Dean Radin episode. That was
a couple of laws, only
a second time I talked to him when I had him on, I don't know how many, like 4 months ago, something like that. That's the only second time I've talked to him or interviewed him in my life. So it was, and it was just as, well, you know what? It was quite mind-bending and revelatory and all that. But the first interview I did with him in the magazine actually changed my view of reality. I mean, not completely. It already changed a little bit, but it was a significant step in changing my view of what I thought was real and what was what time was and what causality was and all that stuff. And I'm sure you experienced the same thing when you talked to him.
No, I experienced the same thing with Chris McBride. But yeah, Dean Radin, there's a meta inside reference for Greg and I. But Dean Radin, yeah, you know, I've wanted to talk to him for years now, having read Conscious Universe, Entangled Minds, seen a lot of the stuff that he's... By the way, I meant that Chris McBride thing in a good way, so for anyone who's listening.
I know.
But a lot of the interviews he's done, you can go on YouTube, and he's been on a lot of shows. A lot of them aren't very good, not his fault. It's just the interviewers aren't asking questions that I think are particularly useful.
No, because they don't
useful.
Really give a shit about what he's doing. They just think he's an interesting, crazy scientist guy.
Well, yeah, plus he's also, I guess he's probably a bit of a get, if you know what I mean. He'll increase your numbers of hits because he has a following, a fan base, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
So he's a, just from a purely commercial point of view, he's a good guest to have on your show. Having said that, it's a better show if you have people who are actually, have read his books. I'm not going to say completely understand everything that he's talking about.
But at least they're engaged in it.
Right. They're interested. They want to ask questions. So he actually joked at one of the things in the episodes. I was talking about religion and spirituality and trying to, you know, the idea of Christian mysticism. And in particular, Henry Allen, who's the 18th century Canadian evangelical who I studied as a grad student in history. And his thing about being wrapped up in God. And we were talking about heaven and sort of the difference between a very individualistic view and a much more entangled view, if you will, where we're all interrelated, blah blah. Anyway,
yeah,
to make a long story short, tune in, listen to the episode, folks. At one point he uses the word ontological, and he kind of stops and he says, my editors at the publishing company have asked me not to use ontological.
Screw on any your of these shows.
And I think there was another word too, epistemology, I think was the other word he used. because it just confuses people. But then it was very nice of him, then he kind of said, but I think I'm on pretty solid ground with you here. And I said, yeah, no, I think I think I understand what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So, that was like Dean Radin tossing me a, you know, I know, kids, you don't understand quantum mechanics, but at least you understand, you know, ontological.
Ontological so, and
epistemology.
Epistemology. I'm glad he didn't use, what's the other one? See, I can't remember words anymore, especially tough ones, but it's the act of blending many mystical or religious traditions into a new whole or a new synthesis, and I can't remember the name of the word, but that
neither can I. So let's just say Fred.
Okay, yeah. So when you use the word Fred, it turns a lot of people off. So
that's right, folks. Google Fred, and you'll find out exactly what we're talking about.
or two or three are probably screaming what the word is right now, but that's fine. Yeah,
well, call in
because we have smart people listening, and that makes me happy. I when I talk to Radin, I feel like I'm always, and I don't know how you felt about it. Maybe you didn't, but I always feel like I'm like a step or two or three or ten behind him, and he's trying very desperately not to leave me to a step or two or ten behind him because he wants to sell books.
I think that's your natural modesty, because I don't think you're like 10 steps behind him. I certainly would never admit to being 10 steps behind him. he's a very smart guy, and he's done a lot of interesting things.
And he's not blowing smoke either. He's very methodical about what he's saying, about what he's talking about when he's trying to convince you of. He's not well grounded in what seems to be, to most people, to be something that is not scientific. And it's very scientific, to the point of it's so scientific that it will confuse you unless you very carefully pay attention to what he's saying.
Yeah. I mean, who knows? I don't have a relative IQ test to compare. I don't think he's any smarter than I am. He might be. I might. But in individual areas, we are more knowledgeable than each other. So clearly in the areas that he studies, he is far more knowledgeable than I am, although I can grasp what he's talking about.
Right.
In areas like history, certainly like film and television production in the film industry, I think also in many areas of at least 19th and 20th and 18th century religion that I studied, I mean, I have a knowledge base in other areas that is greater than his. And so you find points of commonality, I think, as an interviewer and as a guest, too. It's incumbent on the guest to try and do it as well, to say, okay, maybe I know more about this, maybe you know more about that, but both of them are related, so let's try and find a middle ground where we can both kind of converse. And with Raiden...
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, with Raiden, he's very good at that. So is Nick Pope, who I just talked to, who's a very practiced, media-savvy guy.
Yeah.
Mac was always good at that. Nick Redfern's good at that. I mean, I can go down a very long list of people who are good at it.
Yeah.
And then I can tell you some people whom I've talked to who are not good at it. And I'm not going to name them, but there are just some people who can't. Stan Friedman's very good at it.
Yes.
He's probably one of the best at it. Sort of listening to him explain how space travel could work, some people would say he dumbs it down. I don't say he dumbs it down. I say he invites people in and then starts a conversation that everybody can participate in.
Right, exactly.
But there are other people who don't. They just didn't sit. Michio Kaku's great at it, too. But there are some people who just, you know, they exist in their own world and they can't bring it back and kind of engage other people in a conversation. And frankly, no matter how smart those people are or even interesting those people are, I think they're lousy interviews and I don't like listening to them and I don't like talking to them because you can't have a conversation.
No. I mean, if people are good at broadening their, you know, not dumbing down like you just said, but broadening what they're talking about so that more people become engaged with it, then they can get those people to buy their books, listen to what they're have to say, and help them with their work, even maybe, and make the world slightly different, better, or more advanced in their way, and which very few people can do. So when you find people like that, you really want to engage them, talk to them, and that's probably the main reason why the magazine was there and why I'm still doing this when I talk to different people, including you and Nick and close friends of mine. It's just when I talk to any of these people on my show, I learn at least one thing before the end of the show, and usually, 10 or 12 or 20 things. And that's, what more can you ask for in an interview?
See, I like to get the learning part out quickly. So King Zog, there you go. we covered that. And Simeon of Bulgaria. So we covered that very early, and now we can learn nothing and just have fun. But yeah, Raiden's, it was a fascinating conversation. I would put him in my, of all the people I've interviewed over the years, including for film and television, for documentaries, just casual chats that I've had with people, in bars or in restaurants or whatever, he'd definitely be in my top 10. It was a fascinating conversation. It was nice at the end of it too, when we were done, that he said he'd be happy to come back. Yeah. So, I hope to have another chat with him. I had a great chat with Nick Pope, too. Nick and I, we talked a bit about UFOs. I got his review kind of the citizens' hearing on Disclosure. At the end, we talked a bit about Rendlesham, although more about Burroughs and Peniston, his two co-authors and the witnesses from the Rendlesham case who've become very controversial. Yeah. But more about their health problems and their efforts to try and get their medical records from the American military. Yeah. Which have not been successful than we actually did about the UFO case. But in between,
I don't know how much you could talk about.
We talked
about
alternate history and conspiracy theories and anti-Semitism and ufology and a bunch of other things that you probably don't hear, I think, Nick talk about a whole lot because
nobody ever asks him about it.
People don't ask him about it. And that doesn't make me a better interviewer than, say, George Norrie. It just means I have a different sort of set of things that I like talking about. Than the kinds of things that maybe Nick would talk about if he went on somebody else's radio show or podcast. So that makes every interview different. And it's the kind of thing I talked about in my book where, when Bruce Springsteen when he talks about the co-creation with an audience, well, anytime you're doing a radio interview, you're co-creating with whoever the other person is.
Yeah.
Because you can't exist solely by yourself. So the questions, you've become entangled in the interview. So the questions, every interview is different. Even if, and Dean sent me a list, he has a list of standard questions, which I more or less ignored. He said, look, you can ignore these, but if this helps you, here are the 25 questions that, I mean, I have
them too.
Wait a
minute, he didn't do that for me.
Well, it was his coast-to-coast list. I mean, everybody knows, everybody who's been on coast-to-coast knows
yeah.
that you send them a list of questions. And other radio shows, the X-Zone asks you to do the same thing. And I think the last time I was on coast in January, I sent George a list of 15 questions. He used three, and then he kind of went off on his own. He just kinds of they just kind of use them as a starting point, and then yeah. the conversation evolves organically.
Yeah.
But every interview is different, which is why every time you'll hear Dean Radin talk or Nick Pope talk or you talk, you're going to get something different. There'll be a little bit of a different angle. And yeah. that's what keeps it interesting.
Yeah, of course.
I think.
Yeah. yeah. When I was talking about, you know, smarter or dumber or whatever, like in that regard, I'm not talking about knowledge of stuff in a way where you're good at your area of expertise. What I'm talking about is somebody that has the ability to take the subject, any subject really, but the subject at hand, and go deep into it enough that you're breaking new ground, or at least breaking new ground for the person being interviewed or the person doing the interviewing.
And be able
to navigate that. Instead of just, you know, kind of stay in your area and discuss the thing that you know.
Well, by that measure, he's a lot smarter than I am, because I'm a dilettante.
Yeah,
so
me too.
I have shallow end of the pool knowledge about everything, but I never actually swim in the deep end of the pool because it's scary.
Yeah. And I try to stick my, like, kind of walk towards that deep end. And, you know, I think I want what's going on with a guest like that, or almost any guest, is I want them to start, you know, pulling me into the deep end and maybe in some way trying to drown me and seeing how well that I swim while they, you know, kind of swim around in that deep end. I want to join them over there and see what it's like. But, you know, it's like you said, it's kind of frightening sometimes.
It's one of the favorite, because usually when I come on your show or any show, I don't know, I've never taken a poll, but let's say eight people like me and two people don't. I don't know. Whatever. Maybe it's two people like me and eight don't. I have no idea. But there's always somebody who leaves on your website a snarky comment. Usually a different person. So it's not like the one guy.
Really? We haven't had a snarky... Oh, you mean for you?
No, yeah. About me. Not about you. Everybody likes you. But there was one guy, I think it was the last time I was on, and he said, the problem with Kimball is he always sounds like he's trying to be the cool guy at the Dungeons & Dragons convention or something like that. Which I actually thought was pretty funny.
Yeah.
None of these things offend me, but that usually they don't amuse me either because they're stupid. But that one actually amused me, not only because I thought it was kind of clever, but it was also kind of true. You know, it's like, yeah, I'm just trying to be the smartest guy at the Dungeons and Dragons convention. So I'm the dungeon master. I'm hanging out with, you know, some paladins and some rangers and some halflings. Yay, that's what I'm doing. And I'm cool with that.
Yeah.
I don't pretend to be Carl Sagan or Michio Kaku or somebody who understands quantum physics. In fact, I think the people who kind of talk, you hear a lot of podcasts and radio shows where people go, so, and the word quantum, some of them, if I had a dollar for every time I heard the word quantum, I could make a film. I'm just thinking, you know what? I'm pretty sure you don't have a clue what you're talking about.
Right.
Because
so don't act like it. You look even stupider.
Exactly. And there's a flip side to scientists, and we're talking here solely about science, but it applies to everything else, who, like Kaku and Sagan and Dean Radin, who can take the concepts that they're talking about and make it intelligible for people who maybe don't have an understanding of string theory, in Kaku's case, which maybe 20 people on the planet really understand. And then, so the flip side of that,
10 of those are just saying they do.
Right, yes, exactly. They're locked away in padded cells. And then the flip side of that, though, is the people at the bottom end of the spectrum who don't understand honey boo-boo, but they
like throwing words around, like quantum. That's sort of the favorite word that everyone likes throwing around,
yes.
So that they can sound more intelligent than they actually are.
Mm-hmm.
And they are the Joker to Dean Radin's Batman, which is to say they're sort of evil to good.
They're not the Joker because the Joker was smart.
Well, yes, you know what I mean. They're the yin to his yang. I don't know. They're the panda to his Komodo dragon.
Or something.
Yeah.
Adam Gorightly writes in, listening to the show right now, and provided us with the word I was trying to think of the other about 10 minutes ago. Syncretization. Syncretism.
There you go. Exactly. I would have thought it was quantum. It's quantum syncretism.
That's funny because the first interview, the one that went in the magazine, Radin actually brought up that very subject where people don't know where they will misuse a term, especially a scientific term, in order to make themselves sound better or to sell something. What is the term he used? He said, was it quarks or I can't remember what it was, but he said that like somebody will use it to try and sell French fries or something and with no idea of what they're talking about, but it's a buzzword. I don't even know what quantum is, for Christ's sake. If you said, what is quantum physics? I would say, I don't know. It's a branch of theoretical physics that deals with, the world on a level that is below the atomic and I don't know.
I'm not even going to try.
See,
I'm just going to tell people to listen to my interview with Dean Radin. And the funny thing is,
I think I understood it while I was talking to him. See, I get a bare little grasp of it while I'm talking to him, and he realizes that, and that's fine.
See, Radin's not a physicist. Radin's a his PhD is in psychology. He
exactly.
has a master's degree in engineering.
But when he brings up the terms, you know, he uses them properly, as far as I can tell.
Yes, he has an understanding of them. He's certainly gone farther than most people who are not physicists have gone in terms of studying it. But you always get the impression from him that while he understands it, he doesn't pretend to be a quantum physicist. He leaves that. The real theoretical stuff to the people who can do that, but he can take out of it probably more than you and I can. He spends more time looking at it, but he also knows who he is, what he is, and what he's doing. And so he uses that stuff. He understands the concepts, but it's not what he does. So you'll never hear him sort of pretend that he's a physicist because
right.
he's not. But he uses the concepts and he understands them in his own work, and he relates it to his own work, which I think is exactly the way you should go about doing it.
Yeah, because it has a bearing on his work in a way that could be important. And I think more importantly to him and what he's trying to do is that the bearing on his work means that people that are involved in that area, in the respectable side of science, quote unquote, could be talking to him in a way that will make his research more, not respectable, acceptable, whatever you want to call it, to a mainstream scientist. And that's exactly, I'm sure, what he talked about on your show and what he talked about when he was on my show, when I was saying, oh, well, you know, mainstream science is not... It does not accept parapsychology as a discipline and probably sort of laughs at it. He goes, no, that's changing, strangely enough, more than even a few years ago. And it was a nice message to hear from him.
Yeah. Did you ever see the film Madagascar, by the way?
What?
The animated film about the animals?
No, I've seen bits and pieces of other things that were ancillary, like Madagascar 2 and things like that. Never the first one.
Are you familiar with the penguins?
Yeah,
sort of. Evil penguins from Madagascar?
Vaguely.
Your hand ran right into my face.
Sorry. I have a little penguin toy. It's Skipper from Madagascar, so...
I've been hit! Medic! Popcorn! Stat!
I don't know if anybody can hear that, but that's going to be my...
Boys.
Oh, cute and cuddly boys. That's going to be my go-to thing for the entire night. I'm just going to pull that out in places where you won't expect it and drop.
Oh, okay. I thought it had some bearing on what we were just talking about.
No, absolutely.
Pick up some on your own side.
Absolutely not. No. What were we talking about? I have no idea. Dean Radin.
We're talking about Dean Radin, quantum mechanics, and or the quantum theory, and what I just mentioned was how he was trying to not only get a more popular audience interested in his work in parapsychology, but also the scientific community in a way that they could conceivably have a door into parapsychology by through the quantum physics door.
It's interesting. We did talk about that, but not perhaps in the same way. I have a bit of a different view, which I think he agrees with, which I think you agree with. So it's not really different from you. But my view is people always talk about science. And I like to use the line, there is no science in the way that these people are talking about it, in the sense that it's some Godzilla-like monster, some monolithic soul world-destroying monster. That kind of science doesn't exist. What? Well, it does and it doesn't. The part of it that does, the better way to say it, I think, is institutionalized science, which is, and you could phrase it in a different way, the military-industrial entertainment complex science, which has really arisen after the Second World War, because it really didn't exist. There was an industrialized element to science before the Second World War, but really it was after the Second World War, during the Second World War and then after, where science became embedded, if you will, with government, with military-industrial and now entertainment complex, as I like to call it. So that's institutionalized science. That involves universities, academics, industrial research, corporate stuff. And yes, that's kind of career. Let's call it careerist science. We're trying to build a career. Fine. But that's different from the scientific method,
yes,
which is something else entirely, which is really what science is all about. It's a method of trying to learn things.
Yes.
And so you might be able to say that science, you know, let's just call it Mothra. Mothra does not want to talk about psi research. Well, okay, you're not on the FCC, no. So who gives a flying fuck what Mothra wants? The important thing is that there are, see, I made a pun because Mothra flies.
Yes.
And I assume there's another giant moth that he might have carnal relations with, so hence the flying fuck. But there are other people out there like Radin, and there are many others that are employing the scientific method to actually investigate these things because they're interested in them. And as Radin and I discussed, because there are tremendous, which I don't think is actually talked about. People like, they go, psi is cool, telepathy is cool, right? It is. It's kind of cool.
I guess so.
But it's cool to me because there are tremendous moral implications for who we are as human beings and how human society is structured and how it's going to evolve moving forward.
Yeah.
Because, and one of the things that I really enjoyed talking to Dean about, and we sort of riffed on this for a while, is individualism and ego, because this comes up a lot in his new book, Supernormal, where he really talks about Eastern mysticism and yoga and how it relates to these psi phenomena.
Yeah.
Individualism and ego, which is a very, I mean, we all do it, but it's quintessentially American. You know, if you had to pick a country and say, what is the most individualistic country in the world, you would say the United States of America, where even though they don't understand what socialism is a dirty word, even though the way you folks view socialism is generally how the rest of the world views sort of center right.
Yeah.
But this idea that actually we might all be entangled, that we might all be interrelated, I think if not just Americans, I think if almost everybody in any country put their mind to it, it would be, it's a paradigm altering way of looking at your place in reality. And when I say your place in reality, there's, at some point you could say there is no your, there is just one. And it's like the Great Link. We actually use some Star Trek analogies to try and explain. It's like the Great Link or whatever. But he made the point that any time this shows up in modern fiction, science fiction is almost always where it shows up.
Yeah.
So the Borg is a perfect example. It is portrayed in an incredibly negative way, as if this is horrible. It is to be feared. It is to be combated. The Jim Kirk individualism must triumph always, because that's good, must always triumph over the idea of the collective, of the Borg, of
sharing. And we both sort of agreed that that's complete bollocks, as my British friends would say. That, and this frightens a lot of people. And I don't think even the people it seems to frighten the most, it really weirds me out. We talked a bit about this. And sorry, I'm going on. I mean, why listen to my show? Because I'm basically, without Dean being here, I'm giving you everything that's in the show. But take religion.
That's okay. People still listen to it.
Good. Take religion.
Everybody go listen to that right now, after you finish listening to this.
Well, no, you can't because I haven't got it up yet, but it'll be up in a couple of days.
Yes.
I have evangelical relatives. I have friends who are evangelicals. And I've often asked them, well, okay, you believe in heaven. You believe in the Christian version of heaven, but whatever. You believe in life after death. That's fine. What do you think life after death is? And the answer, and I paraphrase, is almost always, well, our personality, me, you know, Paul, Greg, Bob, Fred, Zog, will survive after death. And it's almost this idea that you show up in paradise wearing exactly the same clothes that you were wearing when you left the earth. And you kind of look around, you go, hey, there's Greg over there, assuming you predecease me. Or if you show up, hey, there's Paul or whatever. Right. Or hey, there's Mac.
Oh,
or,
there's the Radio Mysterioso siren. Siren.
Ambush! Call back, man.
There you go. Whoops. I dropped my penguin. And that runs counter to almost every real spiritual or religious text, if you really try and understand what they're talking about with things like the kingdom of heaven, and or that's the Christian tradition, but also you know, certainly Eastern traditions, where everybody comes together. And by everybody, you sort of... I had a very long conversation with Tim Binal on his podcast about this the last time I was on, and he actually said, Kimball, you're scaring me. I don't want to think about it. I want to be Tim Binal. And I said, well, Tim, if there is an afterlife, you're not going to be Tim Binal. You're going to join with everybody else, and I think you're going to be something else. And here's the thing that really frightens people. I don't think you have to wait to the afterlife to get there. The whole point of entanglement, of what Raiden's talking about, is that we're all interrelated already. We just might not be able to, well, not that we might not be able to realize it. We don't realize it. But you and I and everybody else is interrelated. So the moral implications of that are that if you start viewing everybody else around you as part of you, you're much less likely, I would think, you would be much less likely to want to do them harm. It's a good thing.
Yes.
Because you would be harming yourself.
Yeah, that's the same view people have of what's been done to, you know, the environment and the planet and everything. And like you said, other people, if you have this idea that that's not me, then you can do whatever the hell you want. Because, sure, it's, you know, that's not me. I was just listening to a Alan Watts lecture while I did some work today, while I was doing housework. And and as you're describing this, I'm thinking of what he said. He said, well, there's this idea that it was a big bang and everything came from this bang. And then we still live in the echoes or the direct result of that bang. And what it's like, he said, is if you take a bottle of ink and throw it at a white wall, there's a huge explosion bang thing. And it's real black in the center. But then out at the edges, there's all these little tendrils and curlicues and things going on, and that's still going on. And you can look at these little, and he didn't say this, but when you said this, I thought of it. You can look at those little tendrils and curlicues and things out at the edge of that ink being thrown at the white wall. And they're, you know, you can see them for what they are, but they're also connected very intimately to all the other little tendrils and curlicues and everything, because it came from the same thing, the same initiating event, or whatever you want to call it, if you want to look at it in that way, in a time flow causality way, if that helps. But the thing is, that also implies that what you're doing at any certain time is what everything is doing at that time too, if that makes any sense. What you're doing at the moment that you're doing it is the same thing that the quote unquote universe and everything else is doing at that same point.
Right. No.
And that's hard. Absolutely. It's hard to conceptualize. It's hard for me to conceptualize when I'm talking about it. But every once in a while, talking to somebody like Raiden or you, or listening, or Robert Anton Wilson, or, you know, any Tim Leary, any of these people, for about a half a second, you'll realize that that model will be conceptualized in your brain for a little while, and you go, "Oh shit, you're right!" And then, you know, it kind of drops away again, because we're not encouraged to think in that way by every, you know, everything that's thrown at us every day.
Well, we're not now, but it's certainly, that is a, it's a bit of a cliche to say it's a Western thing, but it is a Western thing.
Yeah.
Because Eastern spiritual traditions do encourage people to think that way. And some Western spiritual traditions do as well. Christian mysticism, which is, it's not actively repressed anymore because nobody really within the mainstream churches is terribly aware of it, so they don't actually have to repress it.
Yeah.
Why would you? Because nobody's really talking about it. But it was very much an important intellectual, theological tradition in the 18th century, in the 19th century, and there was a real battle between the institutionalization, and this related to the science conversation we were having, Dean and I, that we just talked about, you and I, this idea of the institutionalized science, the Mothra science, and the scientific method. Well, the same thing is true in so-called religion. There is institutionalized religion.
Oh,
those
right.
are churches.
Yeah. Oh,
and
most
then
definitely.
There is spirituality. There is a search for truth and knowledge and through faith. Those are two entirely different things.
Yes.
And they become two entirely different things in the Western world, but also even in many parts in the Eastern world. But the Christian mystics definitely fall in the spirituality, faith, search for truth tradition. And many people who would be listening, many of my friends who consider themselves evangelicals, if they really looked, I try and get my relatives to read Henry Allen's diary and other things, William Law, if they really looked at the Christian mysticism that underlied the early development of the churches that they now belong in,
yeah.
I think their minds would be blown in a good way.
Yeah, well,
and I think they
don't want
come,
that. So,
I think they would come feel closer to Jesus or whatever particular deity they worship, if not necessarily the incarnation of Christ, then the things that he was saying, the traditions, the philosophy, and find their way to that kingdom of heaven, wherever it might be, if it does exist. But at least it would be a better path to be on than sort of showing up. And my relatives don't do this, but you see it in the United States in particular, these mega churches, 30,000
yeah.
people. It's like
yeah.
a football game.
Yeah.
How is that what was intended? How can you actually have a spiritual experience when you're sitting, you know, basically like a U2 concert, you know, Bono standing on the stage 500 yards away from you kind of thing? Well, how is that? That's not what a communion of saints, as they used to call it, was really meant to be. You have to have a personal contact with the people that you're worshiping with, that you're talking with, in order for it to make sense. Otherwise, it's just people talking to you. Here, and I'll leave you with one other thing, and we'll get off religion because probably bore people. But I was having coffee with a very good friend of mine who actually is very interested in the paranormal. I think he wrote his graduate thesis in theology on exorcisms.
Yeah.
Reverend Kyle Wagner, who's an Anglican minister here in Canada, which in the United States, you guys would call them Episcopalians, the Church of England.
Yeah.
Although you wouldn't say the Church of England, you know, the whole revolutionary thing. But we were talking and he said something that I found really not only interesting, but I was really sort of gratified to hear it. And he said, the word you should never be used in a sermon. You should never have a priest or a minister or a pastor standing up there and saying you to the congregation. It
yeah.
should always be we
yeah.
or us. And I thought, wow, if I had, I might still be going to church. I might not, but I would be more interested in listening to sermons, at least, that might make me think, if I just had a pastor or a minister that said, I am just the, let's call it the first among equals. I'm just the guy that's standing up here trying. And he also said, and I think I said it and he agreed with me, a sermon should never tell you answers. It should just ask you questions.
Mm-hmm.
The whole point of it is us together asking questions and then trying together to find answers.
Right.
And I said, right, this is what every minister, every religious tradition should be doing. Unfortunately, it's what the overwhelming majority do not do.
No, because if they do that, people will run away.
They might run away. You know what? I think people are running away from the churches as it is. Except for it's kind of like the bunker mentality. It's like, you know, when the Jews got on top of Masada to sort of the last stand against the Romans.
Yeah.
Well, that seems to be what the churches are doing. It's this core group of zealots that are saying, look, everybody else has left and we're being attacked by westernized secular society. Let's really entrench. And it didn't work out very well for the Jews on Masada. And I don't think it, you know, works out very well for the churches either. The whole point of the church, whatever your denomination or whatever your faith is that you should be not going out there to convert people, but to have a conversation with people, to tell them what you think, to here's the questions we ask ourselves every day. You should ask them too. And by the way, if you come to a different answer than we do, well, that's cool. But then we can continue our conversation. But we're all on, and you know what? That's, people are listening and they're going, what planet is Kimball on? Because that is so not what people do anymore. And yet there are some people who do it. And it is a tradition that is firmly rooted within 2,000 years of Christianity, in Judaism, in Islam. It's just been forgotten or buried or politicized. And that's what all religions need to rediscover. And that's partly what Radin's new book, in a roundabout way, is talking about and kind of saying, hey, look, science has finally caught up to spirituality.
Yes.
It's finally caught up to thousands of years of Eastern tradition, but also, I would say, original Christian tradition, which is this idea that we're all interrelated. There is, they would call it a kingdom of heaven, but whatever you want to call it, there's something greater than this. We're all connected. And there's tremendous moral implications and questions coming out of that. And so now here we have science saying, hey, you know what? With this quantum stuff, just drop quantum in there. Yeah, actually, that kind of makes sense. These guys had it right, maybe, all along.
No, well, they did have it right, and it was on a quote-unquote intuitive level. But the thing is, once you look at a lot of data, you can keep collecting data forever. But you have to, in some way, based on your, you know, either a weak or a very strong intuition, whatever you want to call that, as a human, make a decision about that data and then try and see if the data, you know, makes sense in light of that. So I think that's been going on for a long time. And what you talk about with religion, I think, is a difference, and we've talked about this before and I've talked about on the show, the difference between esoteric and exoteric. The esoteric meaning the part you were talking about, the individual search and the individual experience with whatever you're searching for, and the exoteric, which is should be the entrance into whatever that spiritual tradition is, and turns into some, you know, the football game like thing you're talking about, which is some people stop at that point and then they never go any further because it involves some soul searching and some looking at who you are and what your place might be. And I think that's a lot of work and frightening to some people, maybe a lot of people. And it shouldn't be, because if it wasn't, maybe things would be a little bit better and people would treat each other a little bit better.
Well, yeah. And if only you had everybody like, and he's not perfect. I mean, people are portraying him as perfect or as this great new Pope. I mean, he has a very interesting backstory to Pope Francis's past in Argentina and how close he may or may not have been to the military juntas that rule there and terrorize that country for years.
Yeah.
Leaving all that aside, whenever I hear a pope say, who am I to judge, as he did about gays, I say two things. First of all, well, aren't you the pope? Isn't that the whole, aren't you infallible? The whole point is you judge, right? But then I go, hey, you're a new kind of pope, which is you don't judge. And you just say, look. And so you start to see, I could actually see Francis and the Dalai Lama maybe having a very interesting conversation.
Oh, well, they would anyway. And it might, in 20 years ago, it would have been off the record. Nobody would have heard about it.
Right. They could have a public dialogue. I could see Francis having that kind of dialogue with the Archbishop of Canterbury or with Islamic leaders or Jewish leaders. And that's that kind of interdenominational thing. Popes and religious leaders of all faiths often pay lip service to it, kind of like political leaders saying, oh, you know, we want to have bipartisanship, but they don't really mean that. Their idea of bipartisanship is do what we say. And it's nice to see a religious leader come along who might actually, to some extent at least, be willing to embark on that kind of, you know, ecumenical conversation, if you will.
If everybody was okay with what they believed, or at least weren't, didn't feel threatened by it, there wouldn't be any religious leaders. Well, there wouldn't be any leaders in the first place. But it's people, I think it has to do with the politics, mammalian politics is what runs all this stuff. And I think that these religious leaders you're talking about realize that and hope that, and if they're decent somewhere inside, what they hope is that some of the, what you're talking about, some of the esoteric parts of the religion, some of the less, you know, whatever you want to call it, the less controlling parts of that of the religion, the less you know, individualistic parts of the religion will bleed through the people that needs to bleed through to. And if they're smart and if they're good people, like possibly this Pope is, or at least part of them, they would realize that and hope that some of that gets out and some people are, quote unquote, I don't know about saved, but have a more personal relationship with their spirituality and whatever they're looking for. And I did not know that this Pope had said that. That's a very hopeful thing. And it also shows that the cardinals that elected him really realize if we don't do something very radical, at least somewhat radical very soon, we're not going to be around here because we're going to be less relevant than we have been in the entire history of this church.
One wonders if they actually realize that or if most of them are kind of going, what the heck did we do?
Yeah.
That's, you know, this guy. And let me be clear. This was in the news, I think, this week or the week before. He's not coming out and saying that. I don't think he's even said homosexuality is not a sin. I think he probably still thinks maybe it's a sin.
Yeah.
But it's a move in the right direction. And yeah, maybe it's glacial, but it was more than glacial. It set off a flurry on Facebook and Twitter all around the world, really. And yeah. it was Bill Maher was talking about it on his show, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, okay, you learn two things. First of all, when the Pope speaks, it still matters. And it matters maybe even more when he says something that is different than you would expect. And you sort of have to step back and go, okay, maybe incrementally we have something different going on here. And that's a step forward, a very small step.
Yeah.
But it's a step maybe in the right direction. Yeah. He also said something else that was interesting. I can't remember the exact wording, but I think he basically said, look, atheists can get into heaven. So, and Bill Maher was very happy about that. He said, look, this Pope is an atheist, which, you know, who knows? I'm sure half the popes have probably been atheists in the privacy of their own room. But, you know, when you have a Pope saying, look, you atheists can get into heaven too. Jews can get into heaven. Muslims can get into heaven. Agnostics can get in.
Who's everybody, heaven?
Well, they're heaven, but how does he define heaven? That's interesting.
Well, I think by saying that, he's defining it as we all have our own versions, but it's basically the same thing.
All roads lead to the kingdom of heaven, and the kingdom of heaven, although we think that Jesus is the Son of God and sits at his right hand and blah, 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 we think you can all get in there. Even if in this life you don't accept that, we think that when we get there, we're going to see Jesus, and that's who he is, but he's not really going to hold it against you. And you know what? If we're wrong, then God's not going to hold it against us either, because we're all going to get in. And I actually kind of like that way of thinking. Well, that's my way of thinking, but it was also nice to kind of hear the Pope say that, too. It's like, atheists can get into heaven, too. Oh, well, okay, that's nice to know. Especially if you're an atheist, you're covered, right?
Yeah. No, but the point, I don't think it was to make atheists feel better by thinking they'd get into heaven, because if they're atheists, they probably don't believe there is a heaven. However, the point was to, and I hate the term reach out, but the point was to make the church, the Catholic Church, to me it sounds like, make it more acceptable, friendly, not as dogmatic and rigid and unaccepting of other people's belief systems, because that's what they had to change. That's what they're probably still changing, because they say we're right and everybody else is wrong and you're all going to hell, maybe they'll be a little more relevant as a faith instead of less as the way they were going.
Sure, you've got 2,000 years of dogma. It's like a sausage, just the Catholic Church, but a lot of the Protestant denominations shared that history for 1,400 or 1,500 years,
depending on
when they broke away from Catholicism.
Yeah.
So you've got 2,000 years of dogma, of all of these varying, and if anybody reads about the history of the church, you would realize, look, what wound up in the Bible, it really is kind of like a sausage factory.
Yeah.
Because there were debates amongst the early founders of the church about which gospels would get in, which gospels wouldn't, which things were actually said, which weren't.
Yeah.
So, and they, of course, they claim we were guided by God in our decisions. And I don't know, maybe they were. But any objective observer would look and say, maybe they were guided by the spirit of what they thought God was telling them, but this was a political exercise.
Or whoever yelled the loudest and had the most money or whatever the hell at the time.
Or the biggest swords or the biggest army in some cases.
Yeah.
So when and they're pulling from other traditions too. They're pulling from ancient Roman and Greek traditions of, you know, the parts that Christianity liked. Christianity is still doing that.
We're back to syncretism again.
When it goes to places like Africa, it pulls out of the native African traditions and religions, spiritualist religions, certain things that will make Catholicism more palatable to the local population. They've always done that.
Yeah.
So
go to a church. We went to a church in New Mexico at Acoma Pueblo, and it's a Catholic church. And you walk in there, and around all the walls are paintings of corn and some of the deities from Catholic religion, syncretized with the they're not Navajo, the Acoma Pueblo Indians tradition. That's exactly what's been going on there for ever since they finally just said screw you guys and kicked all the Catholics out of New Mexico. The Catholics came back and said, okay, well maybe we better work with them a little bit just so we can stay here and they'll accept our religion. And they did, and it's still going on there. And there's no Catholic priest or I think any Catholics really telling them what to do anymore. And they've syncretized that religion and they're fine with it.
Sure, and a lot of it was political in the sense of trying to, in essence, sell your religion. But not all of it was.
Yeah.
And so the whole idea of Catholic...
They took the part they liked and integrated it.
Well, the basic core message of Christian mystics, for instance, certainly within the Protestant tradition, but it goes back into the Catholic tradition, which is very much like the Eastern religions, is this idea that there's only one thing that's really important. And that is, in the Christian tradition, a direct personal relationship with Jesus and through Jesus, God.
Yeah.
So that's it. And when you see a guy like Henry Allen, and Raiden and I talked about this, how he would describe it when he had his spiritual experiences being wrapped up in God or wrapped up in the spirit or ravished by the spirit. He used a number of different phrases, but it was a very much a joining experience. Again, leaving the ego or the individual behind and joining something bigger.
Yeah.
Something, well, not bigger, just let's call it enlightenment, to use a term that Raiden uses that I quite like. You know, the sense of true enlightenment is leaving the ego behind and realizing you're part of something bigger. Fine. Mm-hmm. That is very much the essence of Christianity. It is very much the essence of the message that Jesus was teaching. It has been encrusted with 2,000 years of political crap. And so it's hard for most people to see that message. And when you see a pope or any sort of religious, quote, leader come out and say something like, well, atheists can get into heaven. That is them going back to the original message of their faith and saying, look, the only thing that's really important, even though maybe we can't admit it, is having that direct personal relationship with what we consider to be God. And even if it isn't Jesus, with, let's call it, this paranormal entity that exists. And that's the kind of thing that resonates with me, even though I'm an agnostic. But that's the kind of thing that actually makes me think and ask questions, as opposed to somebody saying, you can't share communion with the Reformed Baptists because they're not regular Baptists. What the heck? And yet people actually argue over stuff like that.
Yes, well, because it's very important to be right, no matter what you're talking about.
It's all about control.
Yeah.
So, which is not what spirituality and faith should be. It should be about asking questions and, in many respects, giving up control.
Yeah, so. which is hard for people to do. And the thing is that the problem with giving up control is that in a lot of cases, if you're not careful, you will get taken advantage of. That's what people are scared of. Rightfully so.
Yes, I'm sure, you know, God's just up there right now looking down on me going, "Gah, Kimball, just like give up control and I can fleece you for all your worth."
But there is a way, as my good friend Peter Stenzel says, and I'm always arguing with him about this, of giving up that control and still retaining some sort of individuality. But the thing is that at a certain point, if you're advanced enough spiritually, I guess, it doesn't matter anymore. You don't, like you said, you're not saying I or me or and you or anything like that. It's either we or it or whatever you want to call it, both and. And I never got to that point. I've gotten little glimpses of it, and I'm sure you have too. But talking about this with you, or to somebody like Raiden, or even my friend Mario, the alien writing guy, we had exact same conversations as that we're having right now. And as you're mentioning this about the church, about the leadership of the Catholic Church, and about exoteric and esoteric religion and various leaders and what they're trying to accomplish, he told me he went to a conference of world conference of religious leaders, and he said they didn't really argue about anything. They talked about their commonality and all the stuff that made them the same and that they were trying to get through to their various followers.
And right, and those are the people
that amazed me at the time he told me.
Those are the people that I would want to talk to. I mean, one of the other points that Raiden made, I think he made it and I agreed in this case, is that going back to that idea of the Borg, so bringing everything, we've gone down this religious side road, but bringing everything back to the original, I think, conversation.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. When it's portrayed in science fiction, it's always bad. And yet, as Raiden pointed out, every time you hear somebody from a spiritual tradition or having a near-death experience or any of these kind of things talk about joining this, let's call it the Borg, this collective consciousness, whatever you want to call it, it's a blissful experience.
Yeah.
It is joyous and rapturous, and you don't want to come back, and you're willing to leave the individual and the ego behind. Even people who meditate, they reach advanced meditative states. This is what they get. So it's not... It's sirens.
No, there were sirens, but I tried to turn the mic down at the time. But anyway.
Oh. It's not something to be feared. It's actually something to be embraced. So in a sense, it's kind of like the guy at the bar. This will probably tick a few people off, but everything to me comes back to dating. So it's kind of like a guy at a bar. So you're at the bar, and really there's two ways to go. There's a good-looking girl over there who is, kind of giving you the look. And if you were to plot a future, you would go, you know what? Maybe we could go home. And if we're not going to get all the way to home plate, I can get to at least third base tonight. But let's assume I could get to home plate and score a home run. So we're going to join. We're going to have this mystical union. And I'm pretty sure every guy would, and hopefully every woman, but I can't speak for them. I can only speak for guys, would say, hey, sex is pretty cool. Making love is pretty cool. Joining up, that's okay with me. And yet, so that's what leaving the ego behind would, to me, is like. You'd say, look, I'm willing to join with this other person and sort of kind of become entangle, if you will. We're going to entangle.
Yes.
The alternative to that blissful experience, which is, and here's what most of us do, we stand at the bar and we go, she's probably going to say no, or I don't know. Maybe, I'm just, I don't want to go over and talk to her. She's probably going to shoot me down. And you wind up going home alone. And so we've become a species that goes home alone, as opposed to we just generally don't hook up with a really good-looking, interesting girl at the bar. Yeah, why would that offend anyone? Maybe somebody will think it's a little sexist, but it works the other way around, too. It could be a girl looking at a guy. It could be two guys looking at each other.
Well, that runs into fear of rejection on the same side of that coin is what you were describing, or I think trying to describe, is the giving up of part of yourself.
Exactly.
And I think what people are scared of, people that don't get married or whatever, is giving up part of yourself to that other person for the rest of your life. That's also a very frightening thing, and people complain about it. And I talk to people that say that they, I'm never going to get married, or I did and it's terrible. And it's like, well, maybe you just don't want to give up that part of yourself to the other person. Or if you do, they abuse it.
Sure. Or maybe you weren't ready, or maybe they weren't ready, or maybe you had a bad trip, if you want to look at it that way. And sooner or later, you'll take the ayahuasca and, the colors start flowing and this is a good trip. And once you have the good trip, you never want to go back.
Yeah,
so,
and then you can't go back. And maybe that's what, I'm in a very nice marriage right now and I still have my individuality, but I'm very happy to give up part of that to somebody else because it's not abused by that person and it never has been.
You're in an awesome marriage.
Yeah, and that's, I think, what people are scared about with to get back to the religion thing, and what I said is that if you give up some of that individuality, somebody's going to abuse it. and you're not going to be able to get back to it somehow. I've got to find something else to be obsessed with, because if you're not obsessed, you will remain a dilettante. And if you're not obsessed with work to back it up, you will remain a dilettante as well.
There's a fine line between dilettante and Renaissance man. So I like to think of myself as a Renaissance man. And
yeah, well,
you
that,
too.
That fine line is a shitload of work that nobody wants to do.
Yeah, it's true enough. But fortunately, I have people like Dean Radin doing it for me. So I can just talk to them and, like a sponge, pull out, or a vampire, pull out everything from them.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't know if obsessed is the right word. Just something that you're so wrapped up in that you don't really see any other way out, around it. You don't think, oh, I got to do this, or, oh, when is this going to be over? It's just kind of, that's it. That's the thing that you are. And most people don't find that. And
there are people listening right now who are saying, yeah, Kimball's wrapped up in something. He's wrapped up in himself. So, and you would be right. Paul Kimball, the coolest guy at the Dungeons & Dragons meeting.
Yeah, well, you changed the name of Red Star to Kimball Media.
Yeah, that's a long story. Don't ask. I also posted something on my Facebook page about the two words that you really need to know today, folks: fiduciary duty. So let's just say it.
I saw that.
It has to do with the nature of Red Star Film still exists, and it's a chapter of my life. You know, I did all my documentaries through Red Star, and who knows what the future will bring. But I don't want to be confined to just one company or one reality or one path, because the path wasn't working. Not my fault. Of my, let's just say, two other people. Yeah.
Let's take that giant train that I've been pushing for 10 years, and let's take the ailing engine, hook it up to a new engine, and take that incredible mass that's still moving and switch it onto another track with a new engine. That's what I'm hearing here.
Well, yeah, the only thing I would say is the idea to go with Kimball Media, or to maybe go more on my own, was not something I wanted to do. It was something that I was forced to do, as when I left the music industry, my bands broke up. My band members just stopped showing up to practices. So at some point you have to go, you know what? Maybe I have to do something new and different. And this is kind of what happened here, where, you know, my partners just stopped showing up, to put it mildly. So now Red Star still exists. If my partners want to show up again, I'd be happy. It's not like I haven't tried. I'd be happy to do business with them. But I can't stop doing business. And I have to continue to move projects forward. Yeah. And I'll move them forward with whoever I, rather than sit and stagnate, I'll do something with somebody else if that's the way I have to go. Not the choice I would have made, but it's the choice that I had to make. And so I'm good with that. Right. And yeah, you know, the egoism of calling your new venture Kimball Media. And yet, I'm Paul Kimball, so I'm proud of my name. My name, I think, means something, honest, good work that I've done. So yeah, you know, that's sort of the way that I'm rebranding it as me. So you either like me or you don't like me. You either want to do work with me or you don't want to do work with me. And that's fine. But that's who I am. So yeah. Boy, there's something. People are going, what? Ah, geez. What, this is not Kim? Ah, it's Paul's therapy session with Greg. No.
Every show I do with everybody is a therapy session for me, and sometimes maybe for the other person. But at any time I talk to anybody about anything other than BS that most people talk about is a therapy session for me. So there's no shame or anything involved with talking through stuff with people. As long as you don't get into the feeling sorry for yourself thing, which I did kind of there for a second, and I stopped it, thanks to you.
But now I'm feeling sorry for myself. No, I never feel sorry for myself. As I like to tell people, I have an awesome life. You know why I have an awesome life? Because I'm alive.
Yeah.
The alternative is I'm dead. So as long as I'm still breathing, as I like to say, it's been a good day. If I get up and I'm still breathing, nobody I love dies during the course of the day, and I go to bed and I'm still breathing. That's a good day. Everything else is a bonus.
Yes.
So that's my baseline. Anything above that, that's a good day. So yeah.
Another thing from that one of those lectures I listened to today while I was doing work. If life is so horrible, why does it exist? It'd be much easier to not have to do anything. to have nothing exist. So there's got to be a reason for everything to exist, and it's got to be a reason that you're here.
You could posit a very
unless you're a goth, you know,
mean-spirited god that just basically throws us in like lab rats and wants to see us kill each other. I mean, you could ask the same question: why do Twinkies exist? They're horrible. They're sort of a kind of a food that is evil, and yet Twinkies exist.
Yes.
So you would think that if that Twinkies, I don't even know what I'm saying.
They existed for reasons because they tasted good. Apart from all the other reasons. Some people thought they tasted good. For all the other reasons you were naming, there was some reason that somebody liked them for a long time. And they were so good that people are, I think they're bringing them back. Some other company bought the recipe and they're bringing them back.
Make it stop. So shouldn't we talk like at least maybe for the last 20 minutes or whatever we have left before you play Gringo Like Me?
Wanted to hear? Because you said something about flying saucer music at some point.
Yeah, I did, but...
We don't have to. I don't care. Anyway, last 20 minutes of what?
I don't know. We should talk about UFOs, shouldn't we?
Okay, I guess
that's what people expect.
You know, I had Chris O'Brien on a couple weeks ago, and I asked for his assessment of the stupid thing in Washington.
Yeah,
and his assessment was kind of bad. I haven't talked to anybody yet who thought it was, you know, what a great exercise. Except probably people that spoke at it who probably thought it was great. Although some people seem to be a bit unnerved by having everybody's favorite wacko, what's his name, the former defense minister dude. What's his name again?
Paul Hellyer.
Hellyer, yes. Some of the speakers there actually were like, I wish this guy wasn't here because he's not really helping our case.
Maybe some of those speakers should have read some of the things that I wrote about Paul Hellyer 5, 6, 7 years ago.
Yes, exactly.
And taken me seriously, because Canadians know who Paul Hellyer is. There's a reason why
his career had ended a while back.
Yeah, like 30 years ago, because we understood exactly who he was. But, you know, when he resurfaced in, 5 or 6, maybe 7 years ago after reading Philip Corso's Day After Roswell, that should have been a red flag right there. People looked, and it's that appeal to authority thing. The UFO, elements of the UFO community, particularly the exopolitics, ET, disclosure, government conspiracy group, are so desperate to be validated that when they see somebody come up with a title, could be sergeant, could be colonel, could be deputy prime minister of Canada.
Yes.
Doesn't matter. But the title, boom. So we don't really care what he's saying because he's important, right?
Yeah.
The fact that a former defense minister, which Hellyer was, and a former deputy prime minister of Canada, which he was, is agreeing with us and saying that we're right, and then saying a whole bunch of other things that maybe we think are crazy, but that doesn't matter. He's validated our existence.
Yeah.
Yes. So we don't care how crazy he is, or the fact that he's in his mid to late 80s and, you know, probably is not completely compass mentis anymore or whatever. They don't care. Because you trot them out there, and it's like, boom, the honorable, you'll always hear them, Stephen Bassett or all of them, they'll say, the honorable Paul Hellyer. And it's true. That is his honorific
title,
in the Canadian political system.
Yes.
But, I mean, nobody would ever call him the honorable Paul Hellyer. They'd just say, hey, it's Paul Hellyer. Bah. It's like nobody, my dad was a judge. Technically, people, even though he's been retired for 15 years, he could still be referred to as your honor or his honor, Judge Reg Kimball.
Yes.
Nobody does that I know of. You know, he's just Reg or Mr. Kimball now. But, you know, so the honorific, eventually at some point you should stop using it. But these people, it's a weird thing, Greg. It's this idea that they're fascinated by Z-list celebrity of whatever sort. So Robbie Williams shows up, the British pop singer, all disheveled at the Laughlin conference. And everybody's all a flutter because Robbie Williams flew in specifically because he's got an interest in UFOs. Well, who cares that Robbie Williams has an interest in UFOs?
Well, I think that's a problem with probably more of a problem with American society figuring that somebody who is famous for one thing is good at another thing.
Well, like, it's a human thing.
An actor is good as a politician or whatever.
Yeah, it's a human thing. I don't think it's just American society, but you guys after you overthrew the British monarchy, you've spent almost 250 years trying to get some form of royalty back. Whether and you still love the British royal family, which is weird. Oh, Will and Kate and their little kid.
Yeah, well, it's like it's you grow up on Disney movies and then realize, oh, they really are kings and queens. They don't do anything. They have no power, but by virtue of where they when and where they were born and who they were born to, they're kings and queens and princes and princesses, which, you know.
Yeah,
you've been brought up to believe is a wonderful thing and should always be around, and you know.
Well, I wasn't, and your ancestors in the United States actually, you know what, the founding fathers were brought up to believe that, and yes. Then for a whole competing and various sets of reasons, much more complicated than yay, let's just be independent and free, they all kind of decided, well, maybe that's not such a good idea that you should have a ruling class.
Yes,
but that idea that people look to other people for leadership and whatever you want to call it, that's the Paul Hellyer. That's the factor that you see with Paul Hellyer.
Yeah.
And you see it, you know, coming full circle to our friend Rich Dolan. One of the problems I have with Dolan is his lack of critical faculty when he's confronted with all of these various so-called whistleblowers, witnesses, and everything else. He just kind of takes them all at face value. He seems to be overly impressed, frankly, by government figures, people who maybe have been in government, by people who claim to have had titles or ranks or whatever. He seems to be impressed by that. And that's probably my fundamental problem with him, is he's just not critical enough. So he would look at a guy like Hellyer and he'd go, ooh, he's former Deputy Prime Minister of Canada. That's what he used to say. I don't know what Rich says about him after the citizens hearing, but... maybe he's a little.
I don't know
maybe
either.
He finally realized. Ooh, whoa!
At some point, I got to have Rich on, I guess, and talk to him because I agree with him on some things. They not agree with him on other things, and maybe he'll. But the funny thing is, I've talked to him many times. Well, not in a while now, but many times privately, and say, Rich, you know, I don't know where you got that from, and I don't agree with you on this. He goes, well, that's fine. I said, you want to come on my show and talk about it? He goes, yeah, sure. We'll have a debate about it. I don't mind at all. Okay, maybe we'll do that.
Here's my core message. Here's my fundamental problem with Dolan, and this is a historian thing. I saw him at the citizens' hearing on disclosure, and repeatedly, time after time after time, he would say, I talked to someone. I had a conversation with Mr. X, or a scientist, or a senior cabinet minister. I think he at one point said in the Carter administration.
Yeah.
You know what, Rich? Maybe you did, maybe you didn't. I don't know. But until you can name who those people are,
yes,
it is meaningless. All we have is your word that you had these conversations. You know what? Steve Greer says he had conversations too. He said he briefed this sitting CIA director, and he's had meetings with this admiral and that general and this scientist and whatever.
That's fine. I may believe you, and the people that agree with you may believe you. But that's not important. What's important is the people you're trying to convince, which is everybody else.
But why should we give Richard Dolan any more credit when he's talking about anonymous conversations and not naming who he's having them with than we give Stephen Greer? And yes, maybe you look at Dolan and you say, well, his track record is a little bit better. Although, you know what? He's been at all these conferences that Greer's been at. So they, if you chart their career, they hang out with the same people, they go to the same conferences, and they talk about the same things in more or less the same way. The only difference is, really, to me, Dolan doesn't go out in the field with flashlights and try and bring the aliens down. Okay, fine. He's too busy with his radio show on KGRA. Fair enough. But, you know, there is not a whole lot of difference if you really look at it between the two of them. And yet one of them is given much more credibility within the UFO subculture, which, think about that, folks, than even Greer is. And the weird thing is, I'm about to say something nice about Stephen Greer after having just said something perhaps not nice about Richard Dolan, who is a person I like much more than I do Stephen Greer. I saw Greer's film, Sirius, and I quite liked it. I don't believe a thing in it.
I didn't see it.
But as a professional, I thought, this is a pretty well-made film. Mm-hmm. Like, I can see the money on the screen. And this, I'm enjoying this. Even though I think the guy is crazy, I'm actually enjoying this. This is a well-made film. So, and I'd say the same thing about Bassett. I think Bassett's a little crazy too, but I give Bassett full credit. Raising the money to do that citizens hearing on disclosure,
yeah,
getting all those people in one place, as a media professional, I know how hard it is to raise money. I give Dolan credit too for publishing all these books at his publishing company and building his own media empire.
And you sort of have to say, well, at some point, do those media interests, you know, are they, it's like the religious things. Are they trying to sell the religion to the masses, or do they really believe in what they're saying anymore? It can be hard to tell, but I don't care. I just look at it and I go, you're successful at what you're doing. Even if I will never agree with anything you're saying, I have to step back and applaud and say, kudos to you, Steve Bassett, Stephen Greer, Richard Dolan, any of the Linda Moulton Howe, you know, any of these people who've built sort of their own little media empires or whatever empire they're building. Yeah. They've been very successful, and they deserve credit for that.
Yeah, you know what? I would suppose I would agree with you, but the thing is that I think very honestly, my nature is unless somebody's doing something absolutely deplorable, morally deplorable, I generally really don't care what they do, even if
I agree.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I didn't think that, you know, I didn't really care about bringing down Phil Imbrogno, because he was lying about his background. Well, it wasn't really hurting anybody except when he got caught. Then it really did kind of hurt because it threw a lot of what he said into question for a lot of people. For me, it didn't. I didn't really care because I liked the theories behind what he was talking about and what his ruminations were on what was going on, whatever it was. I have the same feeling about John Keel. I think he probably didn't, you know, experience, or a lot of the things he wrote about, he probably made up based on the stuff that he experienced. And that's where his theories came from. But the theories are good. I like the theories.
Well, look, I look at David Icke the same way. There's a lot of people who don't like David Icke. I look at Icke and I go, look, I don't have to believe a word he's saying is the actual literal truth. I kind of view him as a sort of Swiftian satirist.
Yes.
Now, he might not view himself that way.
Yes.
He might actually really believe what he's saying. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I look at what he's saying and I say, some of what you say is actually quite a clever, in a sort of fictional way, but that's how satirists often work. They go to extremes.
Yes.
You know, lizard queens and that sort of stuff. We'll read some of Swift's satire and some of the great satirists in human history.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it's pretty far out there. The point being, you know, he's trying to make a point about the nature of the society that we live in.
Yes.
And sometimes my problem with Icke is he gets a little too close to potentially far right wing anti-Semitic groups.
Oh, yes.
And you have to be careful about that. And I'm not exactly sure how close his ties are. But he actually, I find him very entertaining. I would much rather, I can sit and listen to Icke for 2 hours doing one of his lectures on YouTube. And I have, while I'm working, kind of in the background, and sort of every now and then he'll say something interesting. More than, say, 5 minutes of podcast with 90% of the people that are on UFO podcasts. I actually find Icke very interesting as a personality and some of the things he says, even though I don't accept the literal truth of anything he says, because I don't think the queen's a lizard and that sort of thing. So, yeah. And, you know, he's, at the end of the day, he's not doing any harm. Richard Dolan's not doing any harm. And Richard Dolan and I agree about a number of things, usually more things in terms of politics and the national security state than UFOs.
Right.
But, you know, we have many points of agreement. We love baseball. He just cheers for the wrong team.
Yes.
So, you know, it's
absolutely the wrong team.
Yeah, no, quite so. But for me, maybe it used to be personal with some people. It's not anymore. I have nothing personal against Stephen Greer. I don't think he's doing any harm. Now, if he turns into Marshall Applewhite and creates a cult, or David Koresh, that's going to kill a lot of people, well, yes, that's when I draw the line.
Yes.
So you kind of have to look at some of these people, and Greer is in that category, maybe, where you look at him and you say, is he a potential dangerous cult leader? And I don't think he's there yet.
No.
I'm not even sure he's on that road. But if you start to see signs that maybe somebody is on that road, that's when you have to start speaking out against it and stop them. But until that point, you just say, you know what, it should be a free-for-all of ideas.
Exactly. That's how I felt the whole time.
Yeah, Dolan can put that stuff out there. The quid pro quo is that he should not take offense when I critique him as maybe not being a very good historian, because the way that he's doing it is not the way that historians should be looking at it. The reliance on anonymous sources and all that sort of stuff. That's not personal. That's professional.
Yeah.
And people need to be able to differentiate between the two.
Ah, the Skype is finally starting to break up.
Uh-oh.
And actually, we've only got about 5 minutes or a little less left. Do you want me to start the Gringo Like Me, or do you have a parting shot besides the very nice summing up that you just did.
I don't think I've done nearly enough to offend anyone, which means if you post this, what will the people who don't like me say?
They'll find something. They're going to say that you hate Richard Dolan and you said horrible things about him.
But that's not true. In fact,
of course, it's not true. People are going to hear what they want to hear and say what they want to say based on what their opinion is. That's how most people are.
I sent Rich a note a month or so ago, and which he didn't reply to. He's busy. And I said, look, I'd like you to come on my podcast and let's talk about politics and not ever mention UFOs. And maybe that's why he doesn't want to come on, whatever. But you know what? I'll say one other thing. Lance Moody, the Phil Imbrogno thing, just to be very quick about this.
Yeah.
Lance, when I talked to him, he said, and I do know this from having sort of been following it when he was doing this, because he contacted me and others, he was very reticent about releasing the information. He did it more for his own sake, and he understood that by releasing this could be very harmful to Imbrogno.
Yeah.
Now, the truth should win out, but you never know. Imbrogno, having had his entire identity stripped away from him, his fake identity, maybe a guy blows his brains out. Who knows? So Lance was talking about how he was very conflicted about that, how he wasn't sure he wanted to release the information, and he didn't. He's not the guy who released it. Chris O'Brien and Gene Steinberg did, without Lance's permission and without really giving him credit. They released it on the Paracast first because Lance had consulted with them and asked their opinion. And so they went ahead and released it. And then once it's out there, Lance wrote it up and everything, which is perfectly valid.
Yeah.
But they had no compunction about releasing it with the potential consequences. Lance, the evil arch skeptic debunker, whatever that people think he is, actually, and when I talked to him even back then, he was very torn about whether he should make this public. And I thought that was a very human thing of him
to do
and say.
Well, we'll see what Chris and Gene have to say about that. But I did not know that if true.
Yeah, well, listen to the episode I did with Lance. He's very, he doesn't dwell on it, but you can hear just a little hint of bitterness in his voice that he sort of trusted those guys. And because you're friends with Chris, let's just blame Steinberg. Because Steinberg's the go-to guy to blame. As I call him, Gene, Attack of the Rockoids, Major Donald D. Kehoe Steinberg. They released that information, not Lance. So anyway, so there you go. Lance Moody is human. That's you can title that as
the episode. Takeaway at the end of this episode.
Yes. Thanks for having me on. I sort of just invited myself on, but as always, I enjoyed it.
I enjoy it too, Paul. I mean, the alternative was sitting here going, "Do anybody want to call in?" Which is horrible. This was much better. Thanks so much for contacting me. And yeah, you know what? Just about any time I don't have anybody on, we'll always find stuff to talk about. So, all right, Paul.
Yeah. So gringo like me, but I'm going to stay on the line so I can hear gringo like me.
Okay.
Because otherwise, I won't be able to hear it.
All right. Well, we'll start that right now. And our guest has been Paul Kimball, and here's one of his favorite songs, "Gringo Like Me."
Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Be the first one to
stop
fire.
Talking. I can't hear gringo like me. No.
Every man is a liar. There's just one kind of man who tells the truth. That's a dead man or a gringo like me.